He'll be dead within 10. That was enough for now. My eyes turned to the daughter of Rudd McLaren. You can be buying your trousseau, then, I said. For the time will not be long. She looked at me coolly, but behind it there was a touch of impudence. I'll not worry about it, she said calmly. There's no weddings in Boot Hill. They laughed at that. Yet behind it I knew there was the feeling that she was right. The something in me that was me told me no, it was not my time to go. Not by gun or horse or rolling river. Not yet. You've put your tongue to prophecy, darling, I said, and I'll not say that I'll not end in Boot Hill, where many another good man is gone. But I will say this, and you sleep on it, daughter of McLaren, for it's a bit of the truth. Before I sleep in Boot Hill, there'll be sons and daughters of yours and mine on this ground. Yes, and believe me, I got up to go. When my time comes, I'll be carried there by 6 tall sons of ours, and there'll be daughters of ours who'll weep at my grave, and you with them, remembering the years we've had. When the door slapped shut behind me, there was silence inside, and then through the thin walls I heard Mother O'Hara speak.
You'd better be buying that trousseau, Olga McLaren, for there's a lad who knows his mind.
This was the way of it then, and now I had planning to do, and my way to make in the world, for although I'd traveled far and wide in many lands not my own, I had no money or home to take her to. Behind me were wars and struggles, hunger, thirst, and cold, and a deep, splendid bitterness of fighting for a cause I scarcely understood, because there was in me the undying love of a lost cause and a world to win. And now I'd my own to win, and a threshold to find and to carry her over. And then, as a slow night wind moved upon my cheek and stirred the hair above my brow, I found an answer. I knew what I would do, and the very challenge of it sent my blood leaping, and the laughter came from my lips as I stepped into the street and started across it. Then I stopped, for there was a man before me. He was a big man, towering above my 6 feet and 2 inches, broader and thicker than my 200 pounds. He was a big-boned man and full of raw power, unbroken and brutal. He stood there wide-legged before me, his face wide as my 2 hands, his big head topped by a mat of tight curls, his hat missing somewhere.
"You're Saber?" he said.
"Why, yes," I said,
and he hit me. Never did I see the blow start. Never even did I see the bald fist of him, but it bludgeoned my jaw like an axe butt. And something seemed to slam me behind the knees, and I felt myself going. He caught me again before I could fall, and then dropped astride of me and began to swing short, brutal blows to my head with both big fists. All of 260 pounds he must have weighed, and none of it wasted by fat. He was naked, raw, unbridled power. Groggy, bloody, beaten, I fought to get up, but he was astride me, and my arms were pinned to my sides by his great knees. His fists were slugging me with casual brutality. Then suddenly he got up and stepped back and kicked me in the ribs.
"If you're conscious," he said, "hear me. I'm Morgan Park, and I'm the man who marries Olga McLaren."
My lips were swollen and bloody.
"You lie," I said, and he kicked me again,
then stepped over me and walked away, whistling. Somehow I got my arms under me. Somehow I dragged myself against the stage station wall, and then I lay there, my head throbbing like a great drum, the blood slowly drying on my split lips and broken face. It had been a beating I'd taken, and the marvel of it was with me. I had not been licked since I was a lad, and never in all my days had I felt such blows as these. His fists were like knots of oak, and the arms behind them like the limbs of a tree. I had a broken rib, I thought. But one thing I knew, it was time for me to travel. Never would I have the daughter of McLaren see me like this. My hands found the building corner, and I pulled myself to my feet. And staggering behind the buildings, I got to the corner of the livery stable. Entering, I got to my horse, and somehow I got the saddle on him and led him out of the door. And then I stopped for an instant in the light. Across the way on the stoop of Mother O'Hara's was Olga McLaren. The light was on my face, swollen, bloody, and broken. She stepped down off the porch and came over to me, looking up, her eyes wide with wonder. "So, it's you. He found you then. He always hears, and this always happens. You see, it is not so simple a thing to marry Olga McLaren." There seemed almost regret in her voice. "And now you're leaving." "Leaving? That I am, but I'll be back." The words fumbled through my swollen lips. "Have your trousseau ready, daughter of McLaren. I mean what I say. Wait for me. I'll be coming again, darling, and when I do, it will be first to tear down Morgan Park's great hulk, to rip him with my fists." There was coolness in her voice, shaded with contempt. "You boast. All you have done is talk, and taken a beating." That made me grin, and the effort made me wince, but I looked down at her. "It's a bad beginning at that, isn't it? But wait for me, darling. I'll be coming back." I could feel her watching me ride down the street. Chapter 2. Throughout the night I rode into wilder and wilder country, always with the thought of what faced me. At daybreak I bedded down in a canyon tall with pines, resting there while my side began to mend. My thoughts returned again and again to the shocking power of those punches I had taken. It was true the man had slugged me, unexpectedly, and once pinned down, I'd had no chance against his great weight. Nonetheless, I'd been whipped soundly. Within me there was a gnawing eagerness to go back, and not with guns. This time I must whip with my hands. The two-bar was the key to the situation. Could it be had with a gun and some blarney? The beating I'd taken rankled, and the contempt of Olga McLaren, and with it the memory of the hatred of Jim Pender and the coldness of Rudd McLaren. On the morning of the third day, I mounted the buckskin and turned him toward the two-bar. At noontime, sun was darkening my buckskin with sweat. When I turned up Cottonwood Wash, there was green grass here and trees, and the water that trickled down was clear and pure. The walls of the wash were high, and the trees towered to equal them, and the occasional cattle looked fat and lazy. Far better than elsewhere on this range. The path ended abruptly in a gate bearing a large sign in white letters against a black background. Two-bar gate ranged for a Spencer 56 caliber shooting going on here. Ball evidently had his own ideas. No trespasser who got a bullet could say he hadn't been warned. Beyond this gate, a man took his own chances. Taking off my hat, I rose in my stirrups and waved it toward the house. A gun boomed, and I heard the sharp whap of a bullet whipping past. It was a warning shot, so I merely waved once more. That time the bullet was close, so I grabbed my chest with both hands and slid from the saddle to the ground. Speaking to the buckskin, I rolled over behind a boulder. Leaving my hat on the ground in plain sight, I removed a boot and placed it to be seen from the gate. Then I crawled into the brush, from where I could cover the gate. Several minutes later, Ball appeared. Without coming through the gate, he couldn't see the boot was empty. He was a tall old man with a white handlebar mustache and shrewd eyes. No fool, he studied the layout carefully, but to all appearances his aim had miscalculated and scored a hit. He glanced at the strange brand on the buckskin, and at the California bridle and bit. Finally he opened the gate and came out. and as he moved toward my horse, his back turned toward me.
"Freeze, Ball! You're dead in my sights!"
He stood still.
"Who are you?" he demanded. "What do you want with me?"
"No trouble. I came to talk business."
"I got no business with anybody."
"You've business with me. I'm Matt Saber. I've had a run-in with Jim Pender and told off McLaren when he told me to leave. I've taken a beating from Morgan Park."
Ball chuckled. "You say you want no trouble with me, but from what you say, you've had it with everybody else."
He turned at my word, and I holstered my gun. He stepped back far enough to see the boot, then he grinned.
"Good trick. I'll not bite on that one again. What you want?"
Pulling on my boot and retrieving my hat, I told him. "I've no money. I'm a fighting man and a sucker for the tough side of any scrap. When I rode into Hatton's Point, I figured on trouble, but when I saw Olga McLaren, I decided to stay and marry her. I've told her so."
"No wonder Park beat you. He's run off the local lads."
He studied me curiously.
"What did she say?"
"Very little, and when I told her I was coming back to face Park again, she thought I was loud-mouthed."
"Aim to try him again?"
"I'm going to whip him, but that's not all. I plan to stay in this country, and there's only one ranch in this country I want, or would have." Ball's lips thinned.
"This one?"
"It's the best, and anybody who owns it stands in the middle of trouble. I'd be mighty uncomfortable anywhere else."
"What you aim to do about me? This here's my ranch."
"Let's walk up to your place and talk it over."
"We'll talk here."
Ball's hands were on his hips, and I had no doubt he'd go for a gun if I made a wrong move.
"Speak your piece."
"All right, here it is. You're bucking a stacked deck. Gamblers are offering 30-1. You won't last 30 days. Both McLaren and Pender are out to get you. What I want is a fighting, working partnership. Or you sell out and I'll pay you when I can. I'll take over the fight." He nodded toward the house.
"Come on up. We'll talk this over."
2 hours later, the deal was ironed out. He could not stay awake every night. He could not work and guard his stock. He could not go to town for supplies. Together, we could do all of it.
"You'd be lucky if you'd last a week," he told me. "When they find out, they'll be fit to be tied."
"They won't find out right away. First I'll buy supplies and ammunition and get back here."
"Good idea, but leave Morgan Park alone. He's as handy with a gun as his fist."
The Two Bar controlled most of Cottonwood Wash, and on its eastern side opened into the desert wilderness with only occasional patches of grass and much desert growth. McLaren's Bar M and Pender's CP bordered the ranch on the west, with McLaren's range extending to the desert land in one portion, but largely west of the Two Bar. Both ranches had pushed the Two Bar cattle back, usurping the range for their own use. In the process of pushing them north, most of the Two Bar calves had vanished under Bar M or CP brands.
"Mostly the CP," Ball advised. "Them Penders are pizen mean. Raleigh rode with the James boys a few times, and both of them were with Quantrill. Jim's a fast gun, but nothing to compare with Raleigh."
At daylight, with 3 unbranded mules to carry the supplies, I started for Hatton's Point, circling around to hit the trail on the side away from the Two Bar. The town was quiet enough, and a day warm and still. As I loaded the supplies, I was sweating. The sweat trickled into my eyes, and my side pained me. My face was still puffed, but both my eyes were now open. Leading my mules out of town, I concealed them in some brush and plenty of grass, and then returned to Mother O'Hara's. Key Chapin and Cannibal were there, and Cannibal looked up at me.
"Had trouble?" he asked. That job at the Bar M is still open.
Thanks, I'm going to run my own outfit. Foolish though it was, I said it. Olga had come to the door behind me. Her perfume told me who it was. And even without it, something in my blood would have told me. From that day on, she was never to be close to me without my knowledge. It was something deep and exciting that was between us.
Your own outfit?
They were surprised.
You're turning nester?
No, ranching. Turning, I swept off my hat and indicated the seat beside me. Miss McLaren, may I have the pleasure? Her green eyes were level and measuring. She hesitated, then shook her head. Walking around the table, she seated herself beside Carnival. Chapin was puzzled.
You're ranching? If there's any open range around here, I don't know of it.
It's a place over east of here, I replied lightly. The Two Bar.
What about that Two Bar?
Rudd McLaren had come in. He stood cold and solid, staring down at me. Olga glanced up at her father, some irony in her eyes.
Mr. Saber was telling us that he is ranching on the Two Bar.
What?
Glasses and cups jumped at his voice, and Ma O'Hara hurried in from her kitchen, rolling pin in hand. That's right. I was enjoying it. I've a working partnership with Ball. He needed help, and I didn't want to leave despite all the invitations I was getting. Then I added, a man dislikes being far from the girl he's to marry.
What's that?
McLaren demanded, his eyes puzzled.
Why, father,
Olga's eyes widened.
Haven't you heard? The whole town is talking of it. Mr. Saber has said he is going to marry me.
I'll see him in hell first,
McLaren replied flatly.
Young man, you stop using my daughter's name or you'll face me.
No one, I said quietly, has more respect for your daughter's name than I. It's true that I've said she was to be my wife. That is not disrespectful, and it's certainly true. As for facing you, I'd rather not. I'd like to keep peace with my future father-in-law. Carnival chuckled, and even Olga seemed amused. Key Chapin looked up at Rudd.
One aspect of this may have escaped you. Saber is now a partner of Ball. Why not make it easy for Saber to stay on, then buy him out?
McLaren's head lifted as he absorbed the idea. He looked at Saber with new interest.
We might do business, young man.
We might, I replied, but not under threats. Nor do I intend to sell out my partner. Nor did I take the partnership with any idea of selling out. Tomorrow or the next day, I shall choose a building site. Also, I expect to restock the two-bar range. All of which brings me to the point of this discussion. It has come to my attention that Bar M cattle are trespassing on two-bar range. You have just 1 week to remove them. The same goes for the CP. You've been told, and you understand. I hope we'll have no further trouble. McLaren's face purpled with fury. Before he could find words to reply, I was on my feet. It's been nice seeing you, I told Olga. If you care to help plan your future home, why don't you ride over? With that, I stepped out the door before McLaren could speak. Circling the building, I headed for my horse. Pender's black-haired man was standing there with a gun in his hand. Hatred glared from his eyes.
Figured you'd pulled a smart one, eh?
He sneered.
Now I'll kill you.
His fingers started to whiten with pressure, and I hurled myself aside and palmed my gun. Even before I could think, my gun jarred in my hand. Once, twice. Blackie's bullet had torn my shirt collar and left a trace of blood on my neck. Blackie stared at me, then lifted his toes and fell, measuring his length upon the hard ground. Men rushed from the buildings, crowding around.
Seen it! One man exclaimed quietly. Blackie laid for him with a drawn gun.
Carnival was among the men. He looked at me with cool, attentive gaze.
A drawn gun? That was fast, man.
Ball was at the gate when I arrived.
Trouble?
He asked quickly. My account was brief. Well, one less for later, said Ball. If it had to be anybody, it's better it was Blackie, but now the Penders will be after you. Where does Morgan Park stand? I asked, and what about Key Chapin?
Park, Ball said. He's fixing to marry the McLaren girl. That's where his bread's buttered. He's got him a ranch on the Arizona line, but he don't stay there much. Chapin publishes The Rider's Voice, a better newspaper than you'd expect in this country. He's also a lawyer, plays a good hand of poker, and never carries a gun. If anybody isn't taking sides, it's him.
Mostly I considered the cattle situation. Our calves had been rustled by the large outfit, and if we were to prosper, we must get rid of the stock we now had and get some young stuff. Our cattle would never be in better shape and would get older and tougher. Now was the time to sell. A drive was impossible, for two of us couldn't be away at once, and nobody wanted any part of a job with the two-bar. Ball was frankly discouraged.
No use, Matt. They got us bottled up. We're through whenever they want to take us.
An idea occurred to me. By the way, when I was drifting down around Oregon Rock the other day, I spotted an outfit down there in the hills. Know 'em? Ball's head came up sharply.
Should have warned you. Stay away. That's the Benares place. The B-Bar B brand. There's six in the family that I know of. And they have no truck with anybody. Dead shots, all of 'em. A few years back, some rustlers run off some of their stock. Nobody heard no more about it until Sheriff Will Tharp was back in the Badlands east of here. He hadn't seen hide nor hair of man nor beast for miles when suddenly he comes on six skeletons hanging from a rock tower. Skeletons.
Ball took the pipe from his mouth and spat.
Six of 'em, and a sign hung to 'em reading, "They rustled B-Bar B cows." Nothing more.
But quite enough. The Benares outfit had been let strictly alone after that. Nevertheless, an idea was in my mind, and the very next morning I saddled up and drifted south. It was wild and lonely country, furrowed and eroded by thousands of years of sun, wind, and rain, a country tumbled and broken as if by an insane giant. Miles of raw, unfleshed land, with only occasional spots of green to break its everlasting reds, pinks, and whites. Like an oasis, there appeared a sudden cluster of trees, green fields, and fat, drifting cattle. "Whoever these folks are, Buck," I commented to my horse, "they work hard." The click of a drawn-back hammer froze Buck in his tracks, and carefully I kept my hands on the saddle horn.
"Going somewhere, stranger?"
Nobody was in sight among the boulders at the edge of the field.
"Yes, I'm looking for the boss of the B-Bar B."
"What might you want with him?"
"Business talk. I'm friendly."
The chuckle was dry.
"Ever seen a man covered by two Spencers that wasn't friendly?"
The next was a girl's voice.
"Who you riding for?"
"I met Saber, half-owner of the Two Bar, Ball's outfit."
"You mean that old coot took a partner? You could be lying."
"Do I see the boss?"
"I reckon."
A tall boy of 18 stepped from the rocks. Lean and drawn, his hatchet face looked tough and wise. He carried his Spencer as if it was part of him. He motioned with his head. The old man of the tribe was standing in front of a house built like a fort. Tall as his son, he was straight as a lodgepole pine. He looked me up and down, then said,
"Get down and set."
A stout, motherly woman put out some cups and poured coffee. Explaining who I was, I said, "We have some fat stock about ready to drive. I'd like to make a swap for some of your young stuff." "We can't make a drive, don't dare even leave the place, or they'd steal it from us."
Our stock is in good shape, but all our young stuff has been rustled.
You're talking. He studied me from under shaggy brows. He looked like a patriarch right out of the Bible, a hard-bitten old man of the tribe who knew his own mind and how to make it stick.
He listened as I explained our setup and our plans. Finally, he nodded.
All right, Saber, we'll swap. My boys will help you drive them back here.
No need for that. Once started down the canyons, I'll need no help. No use you getting involved in this fight.
He turned his fierce blue eyes on me. I'm buying cows, he said grimly. Anybody who wants trouble over that, let 'em start it.
Now, Pa,
Mother Benares smiled at me.
Pa figures he's still a feudin'.
Old Bob Benares knocked out his pipe on the hearth.
We're beholden to no man, nor will we back water for any man. Nick, roust out and get Zeb, then saddle up and ride with this man. You ride to this man's orders, start no trouble, but back up for nobody, understand?
He looked around at me.
You'll eat first. Ma, set up the table. We've a guest in the house.
He looked searchingly at me.
Had any trouble with Jim Pender yet?
It made a short tale, then I added, Blackie braced me in town a few days ago, laid for me with a drawn gun.
Benares stared at me and the boys exchanged looks. The old roan tamped tobacco into his pipe. He had it coming. Jolly had trouble with that one. Figured soon or late he'd have to kill him. Glad you done it.
All the way back to the two-bar, we watched the country warily, but it was not until we were coming up to the gate that anyone was sighted. Two riders were on the lip of the wash, staring at us through a glass. We passed through the gate and started up the trail. There was no challenge. Nick said suddenly,
I smell smoke.
Fear went through me like an electric shock. Slapping the spurs to my tired buckskin, I put the horse up the trail at a dead run, Nick and Zeb right behind me. Turning the bend in the steep trail, I heard the crackle of flames and saw the ruins of the house. All was in ruins. The barn gone, the house a sagging, blazing heap. Leaving my horse on the run, I dashed around the house. Ball! I yelled, Ball! And above the crackle of flames, I heard a cry. He was back in a niche of rock near the spring. How he had lived this long, I could not guess. His clothes were charred, and it was obvious he had somehow crawled, wounded, from the burning house. He had been fairly riddled with bullets. His fierce old eyes were pleading.
Don't let him get the place. Yours, it's yours now.
His eyes went to Nick and Zeb.
You're witnesses. I leave it to him. Never to sell. Never to give up.
Who was it? For the first time in my life, I really wanted to kill. Although I had known this man for only a few days, I had come to feel affection for him and respect. Now he was dying, shot down and left for dead in a blazing house.
Pender!
His voice was hoarse.
Jim and Raleigh. Raleigh, he was dressed like you. Never had no chance. Funny thing, I thought I saw Park.
Morgan Park? I was incredulous.
With the Pinders?
His lips stirred, but he died forming the words. When I got up, there was in me such hatred as I had never believed was possible.
Every one of them, I said. I'll kill every man of them for this.
Amen.
Zeb and Nick spoke as one.
He was a good man. Pappy liked him.
Did you hear him say Morgan Park was with the Pinders?
Sounded like it,
Zeb admitted. But 'tain't reasonable. He's thick with the McLarens. Couldn't have been him. Zeb was probably right. The light had been bad, and Ball had been wounded. He could have made a mistake. The stars went out, and night moved in over the hills, and gathered black and rich in the canyons.
Standing there in the darkness, we could smell the smoke from the burned house and see occasional sparks and flickers of tiny flames among the charred timbers. A ranch had been given to me, but I had lost a friend. The road before me stretched dark and long, a road I must walk alone, gun in hand. Chapter 3. For 2 days we combed the draws and gathered cattle, yet at the end of the second day we had but 300 head. The herds of the Two Bar had been sadly depleted by the rustling of the big brands. On the morning of the third day we started the herd. Neither of the men had questioned me, but now Zeb wanted to know.
"You aim to leave the ranch unguarded? Ain't you afraid they'll move in?"
"If they do, they can move out or be buried here. That ranch was never to be given up, and believe me, it won't be." The canyon channeled the drive, and the cattle were fat and easy to handle. It took us all day to make the drive, but my side pained me almost none at all, and only that gnawing fury at the killers of the old man remained to disturb me. They had left the wounded man to burn, and for that they would pay. Jonathan and Jolly Benares helped me take the herd of young stuff back up the trail. Benares had given me at least 50 head more than I had asked, but the cattle I had turned over to him were as good as money in the bank, so he lost nothing by his generosity. When we had told him what had happened, he had nodded.
"Jolly was over at Hatton's Point. It was the Pinders, all right. That Apache tracker of theirs, along with Bunt Wilson and Corby Kitchen and 3 others. They were with the Pinders."
"Hear anything about Morgan Park?"
"No. Some say Lyle, that rider of Park's, was in the crowd."
That could have been it. Ball might have meant to tell me it was a rider of Park's. We pushed the young stuff hard to get back, but Jonathan rode across the drag before we arrived.
"Folks at your place? 2-3 of 'em.
My face set cold as stone. "Bring the herd. I'll ride ahead." Jonathan's big Adam's apple bobbed.
"Jolly and me, we ain't had much fun lately. Can't we ride with you?"
An idea hit me. "Where's their camp?"
"Foot of the hill where the house was. They got a tent."
"Then we'll take the herd. Drive 'em right over the tent." Jolly had come back to the drag. He chuckled.
"Why, sure." He grinned at Jonathan. "Won't Nick and Zeb be sore? Missing all the fun."
We started the herd. They were young stuff and still full of ginger, ready enough to run. They came out of the canyon not more than 400 yards from the camp and above the gate. Then we really turned them loose. Shooting and shouting, we started that herd on a dead run for the camp. Up ahead we saw men springing to their feet, and one man raced for his rifle. They hadn't expected me to arrive with cattle, so they were caught completely off guard. Another man made a dive for his horse, and the startled animal sprang aside, and as he grabbed again, it kicked out with both hoofs and started to run. Running full tilt, the herd hit the camp. The man who lost his horse scrambled atop a large rock, and the others lit out for the cliffs, scattering away from the charging cattle. But the herd went through the camp, tearing up the tent, grinding the food into the earth, smearing the fire, and smashing the camp utensils into broken and useless things under the charging hoofs. One of the men who had gotten into the saddle swung his horse and came charging back, his face red with fury.
"What goes on here?" he yelled.
The horse was a Bar M. McLaren's men had beaten the CP to it. Kneeing my horse close to him, I said,
"I'm Matt Saber, owner of the Two Bar, with witnesses to prove it. You're trespassing. Now light us, shuck."
"I will like hell."
His face was dark with fury.
"I got my orders, and I..." My fist smashed into his teeth, and he left the saddle, hitting the ground with a thud. Blazing with fury, I led astride him, jerking him to his feet. My left hooked hard to his jaw, and my right smashed him in the wind. He went down, but he got up fast and came in swinging. He was a husky man, mad clear through, and for 2 minutes we stood toe-to-toe and swapped it out. Then he started to back up, and I caught him with a sweeping right that knocked him to the dust. He started to get up, then thought the better of it.
I'll kill you for this.
When you're ready, I said, then turned around. Jonathan and Jolly had rounded up two of the men, and they stood waiting for me. One was a slim, hard-faced youngster who looked like the devil was riding him. The other was a stocky redhead with a scar on his jaw. The redhead stared at me, hatred in his eyes.
You've ruined my outfit. What kind of deal is this?
If you ride for a fighting brand, you take the good with the bad, I told him. What did you expect when you came up here? A tea party? You go back and tell McLaren not to send boys to do a man's job, and at the next trespasser will be shot. The younger one looked at me, sneering.
What if he sends me?
Contempt twisted his lips.
If I'd not lost my gun in the scramble, I'd make you eat that.
Jolly, lend me your gun. Without a word, Jolly Benares handed it to me. The youngster's eyes were cold and calculating, but wary now. He suspected a trick, but could not guess what it might be. Taking the gun by the barrel, I walked toward him. You get your chance, I said. I'm giving you this gun, and you can use it any way you like. Try a border roll, or shoot through that open-tip holster. Any way you try it, I'm going to kill you. He stared at me and then at the gun. His tongue touched his lips. He wanted that gun more than anything else in the world. He had guts, that youngster did. Guts and the streak of viciousness it takes to make a killer. But suddenly he was face to face with it at close range, and he didn't like it. He would learn if he lived long enough, but right now he didn't like any part of it. Yet he wore the killer's brand, and we both knew it.
It's a trick, he said. You ain't that much of a fool.
Fool? That brought my own fury surging to the top. Why, you cheap, phony, would-be bad man. I'd give you 2 guns and beat you any day you like. I'll face you right now. You shove your gun in my belly and I'll shove mine in yours. If you want to die, that makes it easy. Come on, gun slick. What do you say? Crazy. Right then, I didn't care. His face turned whiter, but his eyes were vicious. He was trembling with eagerness to grab that gun. But face to face? Gun shoved against the body? We would both die. We couldn't miss. He shook his head, his lips dry. My fingers held the gun by the barrel. Tossing it up suddenly, I caught it by the butt. And without stopping the motion, I sliced the barrel down over his skull. And he hit the dirt at my feet. Turning my back on them, I returned the pistol to Jolly. You, I said then to the redhead, take off your boots.
Huh?
He was startled. Take him off, then take his off. When he comes out of it, start walking.
Walking?
Red's face blanched.
Look, man,
You'll walk all the way back to Hatton's Point or the Bar M. You'll start learning what it means to try stealing a man's ranch.
It was orders,
he protested. You could quit, couldn't you? His face was sullen.
Wait until McLaren hears of this. You won't last long. Far as that goes,
he motioned at the still figure on the ground.
He'll be hunting you now. That's Bodie Miller.
The name was familiar. Bodie Miller had killed 5 or 6 men. He was utterly vicious, and although lacking seasoning, he had it in him to be one of the worst of the bad men. We watched them start, 3 men in their sock feet, with 20 miles of desert and mountains before them. Now they knew what they had tackled. They would know what war meant.
The cattle were no cause for worry. They would drift into canyons where there was plenty of grass and water, more than on the B-Bar-B.
"Sure you won't need help?" Jolly asked hopefully.
"We'd like to side you."
"Not now. This is my scrap." They chuckled.
"Well," Jolly grinned, "they can't never say you didn't walk in swinging. You've jumped nearly the whole darn country."
Nobody knew better than I, so when they were gone, I took my buckskin and rode back up the narrow two-bar canyon. It narrowed down and seemed to end, and unless one knew, a glance up the canyon made it appear to be boxed in. But actually, there was a turn and a narrower canyon, leading into a maze of canyons and broken lava flows. There was an ancient cliff house back there, and in it, Ball and I had stored supplies for a last-ditch stand. There was an old kiva with one side broken down and room enough to stable a buckskin. At daybreak, I left the canyon behind me, riding watchfully, knowing I rode among enemies. No more than 2 miles from the canyon toward which I was heading, I rounded a bend and saw a dozen riders coming toward me at a canter. Sighting me, they yelled in chorus, and a shot rang out. Wheeling the buckskin, I slapped the spurs to him and went up the wash at a dead run. A bullet whined past my ear, but I dodged into a branch canyon and raced up a trail that led to the top of the plateau. Behind me, I heard the riders race past the canyon's mouth. Then a shout as a rider glimpsed me, and a wheeling of horses as they turned. By the time they entered the canyon mouth, I was atop the mesa, sliding to the ground, Winchester in hand. I took a running dive to shelter among some rocks and snapped off a quick shot. A horse stumbled and his rider went over his head. I opened up, firing as rapidly as I could squeeze off the shots. They scattered for shelter, one man scrambling with a dragging leg. Several of the horses had raced away, and a couple of others stood ground-hitched. On one of these was a big canteen. A bullet emptied it, and when the other horse turned a few minutes later, I shot into that canteen also. Bullets ricocheted around me, but without exposing themselves, they could not get a good shot at me, while I could cover their hideout without trouble. A foot showed, and I triggered my rifle. A bit of leather flew up, and the foot was withdrawn. My position could not have been better. As long as I remained where I was, they could neither advance nor retreat, but were pinned down and helpless. They were without water, and it promised to be an intensely hot day. Having no desire to kill them, I still wished to make them thoroughly sick of the fight. These men enjoyed the fighting as a break in the monotony of range work, but, knowing cowhands, I knew they would become heartily sick of a battle that meant waiting, heat, no water, and no chance to fight back. For some time, all was still. Then a man tried to crawl back toward the canyon mouth, evidently believing himself unseen. Letting go a shot at the rock ahead of him, I splattered his face with splinters, and he ducked back, swearing loudly.
"Looks like a long, hot day, boys," I yelled. "See what it means when you jump a small outfit? Ain't so easy as you figured, is it?"
Somebody swore viciously, and there were shouted threats. My own canteen was full, so I sat back and rolled a smoke. Nobody moved below, but the sun began to level its burning rays into the oven of the canyon mouth. The hours marched slowly by, and from time to time, when some thirsty soul grew restive at waiting, I threw a shot at him.
"How long you figure you can keep us here?"
one of them yelled.
"When we get out, we'll get you."
"Maybe you won't get out," I yelled back cheerfully. "I like it here. I've got water, shade, grub, and plenty of smoking tobacco."
"Also," I added,
"I've got better than 200 rounds of ammunition. You hombres are riding for the wrong spread."
Silence descended over the canyon, and 2 o'clock passed. Knowing they could get no water aggravated thirst. The sun swam in a coppery sea of heat. The horizon lost itself in heat waves. Sweat trickled down my face and down my body under the arms. Where I lay, there was not only shade, but a slight breeze, while down there heat would reflect from the canyon walls, and all wind would be shut off. Finally, letting go with a shot, I slid back out of sight and got to my feet. My buckskin cropped grass near some rocks, well under the shade. Shifting my rifle to my left hand, I slid down the bank, mopping my face with my right. Then I stopped stock still, my right hand belt high. Backed up against a rock near my horse was a man I knew at once, although I'd never seen him. Raleigh Pender. "You gave them boys hell," he said conversationally. "And good for 'em. They're Bar M riders. It's a shame it has to end." "Yeah," I drawled, watching him closely. "He could be waiting for only one reason." "Here, you're mighty fast, but it won't do you any good. I'm Raleigh Pender." As he spoke, he grabbed for his gun. My left hand was on the rifle barrel a few inches ahead of the trigger guard, the butt in front of me, the barrel pointed slightly up. I tilted the gun hard, and the stock struck my hip as my hand slapped the trigger guard and trigger. Raleigh's gun had come up smoking, but my finger closed on the trigger a split second before his slug hit me. It felt as if I had been kicked in the side, and I took a staggering step back, a rock rolling under my foot, just enough to throw me out of the line of his second shot. Then I fired again, having worked the lever unconsciously. Raleigh went back against the rocks and tried to bring his gun up. He fired as I did. The world weaved and waved before me, but Raleigh was down on his face, great holes torn in his back, where the 44 slugs had emerged. Turning, scarcely able to walk, I scrambled up the incline to my former position. My head was spinning and my eyes refused to focus, but the shots had startled the men and they were getting up. If they started after me now, I was through. The ground seemed to dip and reel, but I got off a shot, then another. One man went down and the others vanished as if swallowed by the earth. Rolling over, my breath coming in ragged gasps, I ripped my shirt tail off and plugged cloth into my wounds. I had to get away at all costs. But I could never climb back up to the cliff house, even if the way were open. My rifle dragging, I crawled and slid to the buckskin. Twice I almost fainted from weakness. Pain was gripping my vitals, squeezing and knotting them. Somehow I got to my horse, grabbed a stirrup, managed to get a grip on the pommel, and pulled myself into the saddle. Getting my rifle back into its scabbard, I got some pigging strings and tied myself into the saddle. Then I started the buckskin toward the wilderness and away from my enemies. Day was shooting crimson arrows into the vast bowl of the sky when my eyes opened again. My head swam with effort, and I stared about, seeing nothing familiar. Buck had stopped beside a small spring in a canyon. There was grass and a few trees, with not far away the ruin of a rock house. On the sand beside the spring was a track of a mountain lion, several deep tracks and what might be a mountain sheep, but no cow, horse, or human tracks. Fumbling with swollen fingers, I untied the pigging strings and slid to the ground. Buck snorted and sidestepped, then put his nose down to me inquiringly. He drew back from the smell of stale clothes and dried blood, and I lay there, staring up at him. A crumpled human thing, my body raw with pain and weakness.
It's all right, Buck, I whispered. We'll pull through. We've got to pull through.
Chapter 4. Over me, the sky's high gray faded to pink shot, with blood-red swords that swept the red into gold. As the sun crept up, I lay there, still beneath the wide sky, my body washed by a sea of dull pain that throbbed and pulsed in my muscles and veins. Yet deep within beat a deeper, stronger pulse, the pulse of the fighting man, that would not let me die without fighting, that would not let me lie long without movement. Turning over, using hand grasps of grass, I pulled myself to the spring and drank deep of the cool, clear, life-giving water. The wetness of it seemed to creep through all my tissues, bringing peace to my aching muscles and life to my starved body. To live, I must drink, and I must eat, and my body must have rest and time to mend. Over and over, these thoughts went through my mind, and over, I said them, staring at my helpless hands. With contempt, I looked at them, hating them for their weakness, and then I began to fight for life in those fingers, willing them to movement, to strength. Slowly, my left hand began to stir, to lift at my command, to grasp a stick. Triumph went through me. I was not defeated. Triumph lent me strength, and from this small victory I went on to another. A bit of broken manzanita placed across the first, a handful of scraped-up leaves, more sticks. Soon I would have a fire. I was a creature fighting for survival, wanting only to live and to fight. Through waves of delirium and weakness, I dragged myself to an aspen where I peeled bark for a vessel. Fainting there, coming to, struggling back to the place for my fire, putting the bark vessel together with clumsy fingers. With the bark vessel, a sort of box, I dipped into the water but had to drag it to the sand, lacking the strength to lift it up, almost crying with weakness and pain. Lighting my fire, I watched the flames take hold. Then I got the bark vessel atop two rocks in the fire, and the flames rose around it. As long as the flames were below the water level of the vessel, I knew the bark would not burn, for the heat was absorbed by the water inside. Trying to push a stick under the vessel, I leaned too far and fainted. When next I opened my eyes, the water was boiling. Pulling myself to a sitting position, I unbuckled my thick leather belt and let my guns fall back on the ground. Then carefully I opened my shirt and tore off a corner of it. I soaked it in the boiling water and began to bathe my wounds. Gingerly working the cloth plugs free of the wounds, I extracted them. The hot water felt good, but the sight of the wound in my side was frightening. It was red and inflamed, but near as I could see as I bathed it, the bullet had gone through and touched nothing vital. The second slug had gone through the fleshy part of my thigh, and after bathing that wound, also, I lay still for a while, regaining strength and soaking up the heat. Nearby, there was a patch of prickly pear, so I crawled to it and cut off a few big leaves. Then I roasted them to get off the spines and bound the pulp against the wounds. Indians had used it to fight inflammations, and it might help. I found a clump of amolilla and dug some of the roots, scraping them into hot water. They foamed up when stirred, and I drank the foamy water, remembering the Indians used the drink to carry off clotted blood, and a man's bullet wounds healed better after he drank it. Then I made a meal of squaw cabbage and breadroot, not wanting to attempt getting at my saddlebags. Yet when evening came and my fever returned, I managed to call Buck to me and loosen the girths. The saddle dropped, bringing with it my bedroll and saddlebags. Then I hobbled Buck and got the bridle off. The effort exhausted me, so I crawled into my bedroll. My fever haunted the night with strange shapes, and guns seemed crashing about me. Men and darkness fought on the edge of my consciousness. Morgan Park, Jim Pinder, Rudd McLaren, and the sharply feral face of Bodie Miller. The nuzzling of Buck awakened me in the cold light of day. "All right, Buck," I whispered. "I'm awake. I'm alive." My weakness horrified me. If my enemies found me, they would not hesitate to kill me, and Buck must have left a trail easily followed. High up the canyon wall there was a patch of green, perhaps a break in the rock. Hiding my saddle under some brush and taking with me my bedroll, saddlebags, rifle, and rope, I dragged myself toward an eyebrow of trail up the cliff. If there was a hanging valley up there, it was just what I wanted.
The buckskin wandered after me, more from curiosity than anything else. Getting atop a boulder, I managed to slide onto his back, then knead him up the steep trail. A mountain horse, he went willingly, and in a few minutes we had emerged into a high, hanging valley. A great crack in the rock. It was flat-floored and high-walled, yet the grass was rich and green. Somewhere water was running, and before me was a massive stone tower, all of 60 feet high. Blackened by age and by fire, it stood beside a spring, quite obviously the same as that from which I had been drinking below. The hanging valley comprised not over 3 acres of land, seemingly enclosed on the far side, and almost enclosed on the side where I had entered. The ancient Indians who had built the tower had known a good thing when they saw it, for here was shelter and defense, grass, water, and many plants. Beside the tower, some stunted maize, long since gone native, showed there had once been planting here. Nowhere was there any evidence that a human foot had trod here in centuries. A week went slowly by, and nothing disturbed my camp. Able to walk a few halting steps, I explored the valley. The maize had been a fortunate discovery, for Indians had long used a mush made of the meal as an hourly application for bullet wounds. With this and other remedies, my recovery became more rapid. The jerky gave out, but with snared rabbits and a couple of sage hens, I managed. And then I killed a deer, and with the wild vegetables growing about, I lived well. Yet a devil of impatience was riding me. My ranch was in the hands of my enemies, and each day of absence made the chance of recovery grow less. Then, after 2 weeks, I was walking, keeping watch from a lookout spot atop the cliff, and rapidly regaining strength. On the 16th day of my absence, I decided to make an effort to return. The land through which I rode was utterly amazing. Towering monoliths of stone, long serrated cliffs of salmon-colored sandstone, and nothing human. It was almost noon of the following day before the buckskin's ears lifted suddenly. It took several seconds for me to discover what drew his attention, and then I detected a lone rider. An hour later, from a pinnacle of rock near a tiny seep of water, the rider was drawing near, carefully examining the ground. A surge of joy went through me. It was Olga McLaren. Stepping out from the shadow, I waited for her to see me, and she did, almost at once. How I must look, I could guess. My shirt was heavy with dust, torn by a bullet and my own hands. My face was covered with beard and my cheeks drawn and hollow. But the expression on her face was only of relief. "Matt?" Her voice was incredulous. "You're alive?" "Did you think I'd die before we were married, daughter of McLaren? Did you think I'd die before you had those sons I promised? Right now I'm coming back to claim my own."
"Back?"
The worry on her face was obvious. "You must never go back. You're believed dead, so you are safe. Go away while there's time." "Did you think I'd run? Olga, I've been whipped by Morgan Park, shot by Raleigh Pender, and attacked by the others. But Pender is dead, and Park's time is coming. No, I made a promise to a fine old man named Ball, another one to myself, and one to you. And I'll keep them all. In my time, I've backed up, I've sidestepped, and occasionally I've run, but always to come back and fight again." She looked at me, and some of the fear seemed to leave her. Then she shook her head.
"But you can't go back now. Jim Pender has the two-bar."
"Then he'll move," I promised her. Olga had swung down from her horse and lifted my canteen.
"You've water,"
she exclaimed. "They all said no man could survive out there in that waste, even if he was not wounded." You believe them?
No, she hesitated. I knew you'd be alive somewhere.
You know your man, then, Olga McLaren. Does it mean that you love me?